Jonathan is the chairman of Bible at Geneva College, and he's also pastor of the Tusker Reformed Presbyterian Church, which is it's right outside of Beaver Falls. So he's pastoring and teaching, and he's been coming here each year. How many years is it? 16 years. He was just a child. His beard was only a little gray at that point. It's a little kid with a beard. It was great. But thank you for the 16 years. Thank you for coming back. And we look forward to another 16 or more with you both. And so after the singing, just come up. I'm going to switch with you the mic in a moment. But let's sing at this time Psalm 119, the B selection. Psalm 119b.
I wanted to thank, and I don't know who all to thank, so I'll just put it out in general. A number of people who I know who've made preparations for me and for June to be at the building this week, and I appreciate that. So since I don't know exactly who to thank for that, let me do that now, and you know who you are. And I also want to say thank you to all who, through emails, primarily emails and phone calls, followed up with me last spring. A number of you know that just a few weeks after I was here last May, I went in for some scheduled open heart surgery. I am one of the lucky inheritors of what probably is a family issue on my mother's side that has taken at least a large number of the Rees men in their 50s. Typically, we've always said that Rees men live into their 50s, and that's about the end of their run. And now we know a little bit more about why. And so I had the surgery, which just went extremely smoothly, and the recovery went. These things take a while, of course, to shake out, but it still went just extraordinarily well. I had such a good experience with open heart surgery. I want to encourage all of you to have open heart surgery. If it was nearly as good as mine, you'll enjoy yourself. but thank you for all of you who prayed for that. To have such a remarkably fast recovery as I did. And I won't give you the details. There are probably a number of things going on. I had a fine surgeon. I went in as physically fit as I could be. Had a lot of people praying for me, and I just want to acknowledge all of those as realities that came together in that event. And I'm just very grateful to have the health that I do. Little word before I read from Mark 9 and a passage out of Mark 14. I realized I was talking with Pastor Gantz just a little while back, and we were just thinking a little bit about what I might do this morning. And he suggested an exegetical sermon, and it occurred to me that I had not done in my own orb an exegetical sermon on any verse directly related solely to Jesus' death on the cross. And I'm embarrassed for years. I've done it, but just not very recently. You know, sometimes when something is so familiar, you know it so well, you sometimes don't think to spend, you know, a lot of time focusing right on that because it sort of seems like you're stating the obvious. And so I thought I'm going to do that. We're going to read a couple short passages, but my focus is going to be on Mark 9:31. And you'll see that emerge as we go. So first, two short readings on this fact of Jesus going to the cross. I've been doing a series in Mark throughout the spring months. I've written this message for you today. This was specifically for you. And tonight I'd like to bring the fruits of something I did just a little while back for our people at the Tusker Church. Father in heaven, I'd like to ask as we read, that you'd help us by faith to take it in, being genuinely redeemed throughout is a lifelong process. On the one hand, in your mind, it was in a moment when we were justified. Experiencing the full reality of that is a long process. And in that long process, we keep getting reminded, oh yes, there's one more thing that has to be addressed in us. And I'd like to pray that those, you know, one more things that we still have would be addressed and changed and renewed or rooted out or whatever's fitting in the course of what we do here this morning. So please take these truths, put them deeply inside of our very souls. I ask this for myself, for the men and women here today, in Jesus' name. Amen. So as Jesus is engaging in what a number of people have called his retirement ministry, starting to focus, bring his public ministry to a conclusion, and some of that involves focusing right on helping his inner circle, we read just in part that as they left, this is 9:30, Mark 9:30, as they left where they had been and they passed through Galilee, they're eventually heading south. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were because he was teaching his disciples. Now, that means in a very particular way. He said to them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And after 3 days, he'll rise. But they didn't understand what he meant, and they were afraid to ask him about it. And maybe in hindsight, that's an easier thing to understand, but for them, these things just didn't add up, at least not yet. Mark 14, verses 32 through 36, Jesus is focused on what lies at this point just hours away. Starting with 14:32, they went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. Now he took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death, he said to them. Stay here, keep watch. And going a little farther, he fell to the ground and he prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. Abba, Father, he said, everything's possible for you. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. And then he pressed ahead. And we know the rest of the story. So we're looking at something very familiar. What I'd like to show and just meditate on with you this morning is the truly strange and out of the ordinary and counterintuitive and just odd fact of Jesus, of all people, going to the cross. But I'd like to introduce it in this way. Those of you that are, let's just say, up in years, not still children, you may remember that when you were young, and who knows, maybe still today, there's a little type of puzzle that a lot of us have memories of. It's one of these puzzles where someone has drawn a picture, usually of a familiar scene. It's drawn a picture of something, and the caption asks you, what's wrong with this picture? Remember those kind of puzzles? And you have to look very carefully. And, you know, for example, the scene might be, a family sitting at home in the evening, doing the various things. Dad sitting on the chair, mom's in the kitchen, kids are playing on the floor or something. And at first glance, it looks like a household scene. And then the puzzle part, you have to look very carefully. And you realize, the dog's reading the paper, and dad has his dirty yard tools, on his lap in the chair, that kind of thing. Mom's throwing dinner out the window, whatever. I mean, these kind of crazy, little things. But you only get them when you focus and you look at the details and you say, well, there's a lot wrong with this picture. My first conscious awareness of reckoning with the fact of Jesus going to the cross was one of those kinds of experiences. It's still etched in my memory. I was 14 years old. I was in public school, and I had been taken out for a milkshake. You can bribe me with a couple basic things always: donuts, milkshake, and ice cream. It's a winning combination. And if you have all three, I'm putty in your hands. And I was experiencing family difficulties, and my parents' home was falling apart. And this teacher was a Christian teacher, was very cognizant of those things. And he invited me out for milkshake. And I didn't realize this, but I knew he led a high school fellowship group, but I didn't realize I was sort of next on his list. And he asked me a very interesting question. He knew I was the son of an ordained pastor. I'd grown up in the church. I was, you know, aware of the religious stuff of the Bible, at least in a very general way. And he said to me, "Why do you think Jesus came to earth?" And he knew I had the background, at least to be aware of that, of the fact of the incarnation. And I thought for a moment. I remember very clearly what I answered. I said, "Well, I suppose to do good things and to set an example for us." You know, like a very reasonable kind of answer. I could prove in the Bible all the good things that Jesus did. And he said to me, he just paused, and in a very simple response, he says, "The primary reason Jesus came to earth was to die." Now, I don't know what I said to him. I don't have any recollection of that, but I remember very well what I thought. And my thought was instant. It was, that's a ridiculous idea. I'm still thinking in your typical human logical kind of way. Everyone knows, I'm saying to myself, everyone knows, you don't come to life for the purpose of dying. You know, things come to life so they can live. It just doesn't make sense that you would come to life so that you could end your life. It just, that's a circle. It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous idea on all these levels. Why would someone willingly undergo horrible suffering? Why would someone willingly give up opportunities to do good things for people? Let's face it, Jesus did a whole host of wonderful things, the kind of things where you'd want to say to him, you know, "You're on a roll, keep going, you know, don't stop." That was my thinking at the time. And I had to, of course, go through a major change. In fact, that question was posed to me on a Wednesday of this particular week in 1972. It was posed to me on a Wednesday, and by Saturday, I was at the foot of the cross. So within days, it would lead to a sequence of things. There was nothing less than my dramatic conversion from the desperate, broken loneliness of teenagehood, and mine was desperate in many ways. This ridiculous idea led to me coming to a whole new life. So why not ponder a little bit about, you know, what's going on with that? I'm interested in the fact that, you know, when Peter first encounters this idea, I think his response in his own wording and way was a little bit like mine. By the way, happens to be back in chapter 8 of Mark. His first chance to hear people, to hear Jesus say to Peter, "This is what's going to happen." You may remember Peter's response is to rebuke Jesus. Doesn't tell us his exact words other than, "May it never be." But his response in so many words is, "That's ridiculous. That's not what you want." Of course, Jesus rebukes Peter. So it's not surprising when we get to what here in our text is now the third occasion, according to Gospel of Mark, third occasion for Jesus to start to do this, that now it says that the apostles were a little bit afraid to ask him much about it. It's not that they're foolish or ignorant or anything, but they are, in a sense, they are ignorant, that they just don't get the big picture. It's being opened up to them. So I'd like to look at three aspects of Mark 9:31 with you. Let me reread it. I'm working out of the New American Standard at this point, so the wording may be a little bit different than your NIV. It just says that Jesus was teaching his disciples and telling them, "The Son of Man is to be delivered up into the hands of men. They will kill him. And when he's been killed, he'll rise again 3 days later." I'd like to look at it in terms of sort of three headings or rubrics, whatever you want to call it. Just a little bit about the etiology or origins of the cross, the psychology of the cross, briefly, and then the theology of the cross, and have that lead us to what it means for you and me right now. I'd like to point out first that Jesus, and this is the Greek, you see it nicely in English, it says he was teaching and telling. And for many of us, especially those of us who like language that is concise and to the point, this seems a little bit of a roundabout way of getting to something. It probably is the way Mark is being very intentional about the fact that Jesus is being very intentional. He was teaching and telling. It's a bit of a redundancy from our point of view. It's an emphasis, I think, from his point of view. because it took a while to get them used to this ridiculous idea that he would willingly face that kind of an end of life. Now, the cross, as you may have done some reading, had a bit of a history. Many people will say it was a distinctively Roman form of punishment, and the Romans certainly honed the process. I'm not going to talk about it this morning. That's not for here. You know, of course, it has really a history prior to the Romans, and different peoples of ancient empires certainly did it. The Assyrians did their version. The Persians did their versions. In a sense, there's something just very, if you will, basic about impaling a person one way or another so that he dies an agonizing and protracted death. But really, it's not rooted in history, at least in tangible history. It's rooted in abject human depravity. Its origins are in the imagination of human beings who, it seems, never run short of being able to find horrible ways to treat other people. These words, and I'm just quoting Jesus, he'll be delivered into human hands, are awful. What an awful way to go, to be totally at the mercy of someone else to do whatever their perverted mind and heart wants to do to you. Again, with no details, we're a mixed group here, and this would not be appropriate to talk the ugly stuff. But, you know, read, for example, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, about what people do to people. It's unspeakable, and there's lots of other things you can read as well. And I was interested, I thought about this connection I had never thought about before. We usually think about how horrible it is to be in the hands of God because he's the judge of all. There's a whole place to discuss that. But for a moment, think about the other option, being put into the hands of other human beings whose only interest is to do the unspeakable. And I was drawn in this connection to a little story. You may remember this. I'm not going to read the story, but I just want you to know it's real. I'm not making it up. It's in 2 Samuel 24. And King David has had his kingdom in many ways affirmed and settled. It's a good time in his life and the kingdom's life. And he decides to just sort of, you know, reinforce it all. He'll take a census, and God did not want him to count on his human strength and the kingdom's human strength. And so he's going to choose a punishment. And you can sort of get to the point around chapter 24, verse 14. And so God, through the prophet Gad, gives him some choices. You can suffer some years of famine, or, you know, some time when your foes pursue you, or 3 days pestilence. Now, God would send this special pestilence for 3 days. It's an interesting concept. You choose which disciplining you're going to have. I'm interested in David's response. This is what I want to get at. David says to the prophet, "I'm in distress, but let's now fall into the hand of the Lord." I'll take a pestilence, in other words. Let's fall in the hand of the Lord because his mercies are great. Do not let me fall into the hand of man. He gets that, how horrible that would be. So here is Jesus, will fall into the hands of man, using David's wording. The kind of thing David didn't even want to experience. How horrible to do that. To be put at the mercy of people who will make the ultimate human presumption. Think about this. Think about the ultimate human presumption where a human being looks another human being in the eye and says in so many words, "I will decide if you get the right to live. And if I decide you'll die, I will decide how you will die. And I will decide when you will die. And I will decide all the suffering that goes between this point and this." Can't even imagine it. Can you? It's a horrible thing to fall into the hands of man. It's no wonder the Roman statesman Cicero, thinking about this, said, "Let the thought of the cross be far from the Roman mind." I assume he had seen it done, and he knew how horrible it was. It's not surprising, by the way, that people came up with euphemisms for that experience. One of the euphemisms that has been substantiated by people who study this topic is the phrase, to be lifted up. It's an ironic phrase because in Old Testament parlance, when someone is lifted up, the wording means they're being honored. You know, you lift up a king. The king lifts up a loyal subject, meaning holds them up so that other people can look at their fame and their reputation. So with normally in other settings, to be lifted up would be the kind of thing, you know, you might want to have happen to you. The fact about euphemisms is you sometimes take something and you give it this bitter twist. In this case, a person gets lifted up, but the outcome, of course, is completely the opposite. It seems, by the way, even Jesus uses this euphemism. In John 3:14, as he's talking to Nicodemus, he says, you know, as the snake was lifted up in the desert by Moses so that people could be healed of their snake bites, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up. It seems he himself is using it right there. So here is this ridiculous idea tying in now with the way the cross thing develops. Everything's inverted. Here is the vehicle for the creation of life. Jesus is the means through whom God created the earth. Here's the vehicle for the creation now being subjected to the creation. Isn't that weird? I don't mean to trivialize this, but can I just give you a daily example that a lot of you have experienced? They'll give you this idea of this strange inversion. Can you remember, those of you who are at least teenagers, at least, like older teenagers, with your license, can you remember the first time that your father or your mother, who up to that point had always been the one to drive you in a car, hands over the keys once you've had your license, and now here you are for the first time holding their life and safety in your own hands. Can you remember that moment? I do. It's a very strange thing at age 16. I looked up to my father. My father was strong. He was athletic, capable, one I trusted. And here he was saying to me, now you have the opportunities, the responsibility, the capability. It was a strange inversion. Okay? So here, on a much greater level, of course, is the vehicle for creation putting himself under the creation's hand. What a strange, ridiculous idea. The Prince of Life, who's given life to all, is going to experience death? I can hardly wrap my mind around that. Tells us in the Gospel of John in a number of ways, he keeps loving them even as they reject and bruise and cut and beat and insult and bring him to death. And he keeps loving them. This is why C.S. Lewis put it, as he kind of captured the whole experience of Jesus. With the incarnation, he said, myth became reality. It's what you see happening right here. Briefly, second point, the psychology of the cross. It meant different things to different people that day, and it doesn't always correspond exactly to the way we see it. Most of us today think from the point of view of the victim, which is a great place to start, by the way. I have nothing wrong with that, who will end his or her life in abject terror. Imagine, you know, your last breathing moments of experience of this life being under those circumstances, and all of the anticipation, the suffering that goes with just the anticipation of what's going to happen, as best you can imagine, what a horrible effect on a person. That's a good place to start. It's not the only place to go. To the Roman Empire, to people who were happy Romans, if you will, the cross, which was reserved only for non-Roman citizens, generally speaking, was the elimination of an enemy of the brilliance of the empire. You realize this? People were proud of Roman government, proud of Roman history, proud of Roman cultural traditions, proud of Roman architecture, proud of Roman jurisprudence, proud of Roman technology. Proud of Roman military brilliance. By the way, do you know that Rome, at the time of Jesus, brought in more fresh water to its city every day than New York City was doing in 1985? That's a city proud of being clean. Literally. They loved it. I can't blame them. Okay? And so they looked at the cross as, this is the elimination of people who threaten all that we have. Amazing human bravado. It goes with this. To Jewish people, of course, it's not always going to be the same. But the cross means divine condemnation. And the particular connection they were making, at least many of them were making, is if we can get Jesus out of the way, and out of the way in this very particular way, he will be held up to public disgrace. It's not only, the execution, but it's in a public place. And after death, you're left in a public place for people to look and to sneer and to throw contempt. And by the way, this is not totally apart from cultures. You realize that, just to take one example of this in relatively recent times, when a number of American Marines were killed in 1979 trying to rescue hostages out of Iran, when some of them were killed in the desert, their body parts were taken to the city of Tehran and hung up publicly for disgrace. You see, so the idea is our people, whoever that happens to be, detest you for your offensiveness to us and your offensiveness to God as well. To the family and the friends, the survivors, even if they love the person, and many would, of course, who had been executed this way, it would be a lifetime of embarrassment and shame and alienation, not because you want that or even that your neighbors want that, but it is so public, and sometimes it's not the visual, it's the auditory memories that haunt you for so long. You'd never be able to shake those memories. You would go, as one of the survivors of someone who had been crucified, you would go to your own grave with these imprints in your eyes and in your imagination and in your ears of what had been done that day. How would you ever shake it? It would do everybody this huge disservice. But I want to focus on the third and final piece, this angle on Mark 9:31, and that is the theology of the cross. I'm going to start with, at first, a very innocuous little phrase. It's a familiar one to all of you. Jesus says, it's the Son of Man who's going to be delivered. And I know for many, it's an understandable mistake. Many imagine that the phrase, Son of Man, is Jesus' reference to his humanity, and he was truly, truly human. But in fact, if you look carefully at how Jesus uses that a number of times through his ministry, it's a rather unique phrase he uses of himself. The church later doesn't address him that way. We don't either. It's something uniquely Jesus uses of himself. The Son of Man, you'd realize the Son of Man must be in association with that vision that Daniel had, so to speak, where the people of his time being consigned to the fiery furnace see someone like a Son of Man, someone human in form, but he clearly isn't just a human being. His association with the presence of deity. And the way Jesus uses it, you can start to see it. For the Son of Man's involved in forgiving of sins. The Son of Man is involved with coming at the end of history and bringing in judgment. You get those kinds of angles and you realize from Jesus' own imagination, yes, he's referring to himself, but the Son of Man is a mark of deity, not of his humanity. So the Son of Man will be delivered. And I like to take some of the other phrases that people have used, particularly Paul, has used to try and get at that fact and dynamic. So here is 2 Corinthians 5:21. God made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf. God took him who knew no sin, made him that way to become sin, the substitute for us. Or here's another number of places, actually, from Psalm 16 and all the way into the New Testament, when it talks about Jesus being unable to be detained by death. Death couldn't hold him. He was in the grave temporarily, but it was not possible to leave him there. He had to be taken out. He could not be grasped by death. Great people in that history, powerful people, brilliant people, deadly people, delightful people, all eventually get grasped by death and not let go. He could not be held, and it was not possible for him to be detained. And when he was resurrected, here's now Paul's phrase in Romans 1:4, when he was resurrected, he was declared with power to be the Son of God. Now remember, he was already the Son of God. That wasn't something new. But he's declared with power. If something happens, it affirms the claim. Anyone can say words, but if someone can say words and then see something miraculous affirm the words, that's declaration with power. Jesus was declared with power to be the Son of God. And that when that happened, and I'm now coming over to the great resurrection chapter of 1 Corinthians 15, he became a first depositor, like a down payment of something that's more to follow. What happened with his resurrection, we're told in 1 Corinthians 15 and elsewhere, what happened with him is guaranteed to be something that's given to those who are joined to him in faith. All right. So he's first. We'll follow in the time that God sees fit. And because you wonder, how do I know it's going to happen? The answer is because it happened to him. You're attached to him. It's going to happen to you and to me. And you don't have to worry if you're good enough, strong enough, capable enough, virtuous enough. Don't worry. You're not. None of us are. But because we're attached to him, it will be our experience. He tasted death for us. He tasted resurrection from the grave for us as well. We need this. We cannot supply it for ourselves. We were in a helpless situation. I like the way Romans 5, verses 6 and 8 comment on this. While we were yet sinners, while we were still helpless, he died for us. In other words, if even in our detestable, contemptible state, God did these things for us, how much more will he continue to do good in all the years that follow? Here's the ridiculous idea at this point, that anything vicarious can be done for us. Because normally in life, it doesn't work that way. You know, if you were sick and you just don't want to go to the doctor, Your spouse or your child or your parent can say, don't worry, I'll go to the doctor and get treated on your behalf and you'll get better. You know that doesn't work. At that level, vicarious stuff never works. On this level, it does. See, amazing. That's a ridiculous idea. He was punished for us. He was resurrected for us. He was glorified for us. And we're going to be the ones taking on all of those benefits. Some ridiculous ideas are wonderful. They're rejuvenating. They mean new life, new hope, and a whole new future that we couldn't have imagined before. So you know that phrase from one of the servant passages, one of the servant songs of Isaiah, the suffering servant passage of Isaiah 53. By his wounds, we become healed. In God's economy, something ridiculous like that vicarious experience does happen. And I'd like to bring this to conclusion by just asking you to think about that with me for a moment. Consider the range of things in you that need to be healed. Many of us will happily say, I know my sins. And what we really mean by that is, I know some of my sins. And I do admit, I wonder sometimes why God takes long time to bring us from, you know, where he grabbed us to where, you know we need to be. It just seems like, well, it is a long time from our perspective. But I think part of that is God showing us there's a huge range of reconstructions in our souls, in our hearts, in our motivations, in our very being. It's an awful lot of work still to be done. I imagine, again, I'll be vague, but I talked to a friend years ago, a Czechoslovakian man who, in fighting in World War II, took a bullet from behind his head and came out the front. And he said he went through 50 surgeries. And they were mostly small surgeries, but it took 50 surgeries to reconstruct him. Now, when I knew him decades later, he looked absolutely normal. There was no hint of any injury. And then he showed me the picture of the day he had been shot. It was a horrific picture. And here, over a period of time, he had been repeatedly attended to until all of his wounds were healed. And it was a beautiful, beautiful picture. We're like that on far more level. The range of things to be healed is extensive. And so the rate of things, I think God gives us this time to remind us this is not a quick job. It's not an easy thing. It's, as someone has put it, there's an old house being torn down at the same time a new house is being built up. And so it takes a while. But I would like to leave you with this thought. If God has done all these things, and as much as he's doing these things in you, if the Creator could deal with deeply problematic things in you, and then in dealing with them, he lets them go. He forgives them. He, if you will, moves on, as we like to say. If he does that, I think we have a very powerful example to do the same. And in life, we're going to have situations that deeply disappoint us. We will encounter people who offend or annoy us or also disappoint us. We'll find out things about ourselves where we're terribly, terribly disappointed sometimes. I wish that wasn't this way. We're going to see a whole host of things, and I'm going to guess most of you will say, I've already seen my whole host of things. And you realize, as God encounters these host of things in his people, he deals with them. He doesn't ignore the things. He deals with them, but he keeps moving on. And so we need to take that forgiveness and healing and changing. And we also have to be those kinds of people who, of whom it's not said, as was said, unfortunately, of one of my more embittered friends recently, he's a guy who can't forget anything or let anything go. Don't be like that. Don't be like that. Because God is not like that to you. But in Christ, as this healing, these wounds of his that become our betterment takes place, we're called to, in that kind of a spirit, deal with the people and the situations in our lives that have been most disappointing. If it takes you time to do that, no problem. We've got all the time, so to speak, all the time in the world, at least for now. But may it be that we who have known healing and forgiveness should extend that to those in our lives as well. Father in heaven, thank you for letting us see in the cross this wealth of profound eternal truths, even through the angle of something that is nothing less than a representation of the utter perversity of fallen human nature. Ultimately, it can point us to the depths of divine imagination, divine power, divine grace. And may that be what flows through us and enlivens our life. In Jesus' name, we pray for that this morning.